Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian from Simi Valley, California. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We've got a big program for you this week from the Reagan National Defense Forum at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, where our coverage was sponsored by Boeing and Leonardo DRS. Later in the show, our interview with Admiral Phil Davidson, the commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, our roundtable on the week on world markets, and War Words, a new play by Michelle Colas Brooks in partnership with the Atlantic Council think tank that opened up this week in Venice, California. But first, while we were at the Reagan Forum and Congress was moving ahead with the National Defense Authorization Act, we caught up with Representative Adam Smith, the Washington Democrat who is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. A major focus of the forum this year was America's great power competition with China. Here is our conversation with Chairman Smith. And joining us now is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Adam Smith, who is from the great state, a Democrat from the great state of Washington. Sir, thanks very much for spending some time with us.
It's great to be here. I appreciate the chance.
It isn't the Reagan Forum unless we have an opportunity to talk. I want to talk about the great power competition we're in. Yeah. You had some very thoughtful comments about how to couch and to think about this competition over the strategic long term. Do you think that we have the kind of integrated strategy, you know, you couched it as authoritarianism against democracy is the way to fundamentally look at this competition. Do we have the right approach and understanding for the competition ahead if you think of it on a fundamental level? Do we have the kind of strategic foresight and understanding of our adversary that we need? And are we able to then act on that?
Basic issue at this point, I think we do have the capability of doing this. It's a matter of the clarity of the challenge. And that's what we've lacked leadership on the executive side to give that, you know, clarion call that this is what's going on. You know, on the one side, we have economic and political freedom. On the other side, we have authoritarianism and kleptocracy. We need to fight this battle. And I think we need to make the case for why our model is better. And actually, I forget there was a panelists. Someone made the point at the end there that, it was a meeting I had later, actually, after this, where someone made the point that we're going to be better because of freedom, because of innovation, because you don't have someone at the top controlling it, because we're going to allow, you know, our system encourages entrepreneurs and individuals to think freely. When they do that, they come up with better ideas, they create better products, they build a better society. So no, I don't think at this point we've given it the intense focus and the clarity of the challenge. We have the capability. I don't doubt that at all. Our capital markets, our education system, you know, the number of entrepreneurs we have, the way our system is set up, we have to be clear on the challenge, and I don't think we've done that yet.
We have a tendency of sometimes being surprised at what the Chinese do, right? Whether it was about building islands or fishing militias or 15,000-ton Coast Guard cutters, and this notion that they're competing against an extremely broad front and on a very, very slow cycle to sort of change the realities, to present those fait accomplis. From your standpoint, do we have enough strategic foresight to sort of anticipate the next thing that the Chinese are going to do?
I never personally obsess about the fact that occasionally we don't predict the next step. I mean, it's an unpredictable world. I think we have enough foresight to play our advantage. Yeah, they're going to surprise us. We're going to surprise them. I've never been up against an adversary in anything where they didn't occasionally surprise me. You have to be able to adapt and be flexible to those surprises, and I think we can. But overall, it's a matter of really focusing our energy on what the struggle is and making the investments necessary to win.
There are strategists who are looking at the portfolio of systems we have now and saying that there actually could be of marginal utility in a future conflict. You spend a lot of time thinking and looking at this. How large are the muscle movement changes we have to make from your estimation?
I think the biggest problem is when people talk about conflict, they tend to focus on war gaming, what a war with China would be in the South China Sea. That's not the conflict that we're in or likely to have. The conflict we're in is a conflict of ideas. It's a conflict of intellectual property. It's a conflict of technology. It's an economic and political competition. So if we're spending all this time wargaming what we have to build in order to win some hypothetical war that in all likelihood is never going to be fought, we should be investing in figuring out how to fight the actual conflict that's going on right now, which is a conflict over ideas. It's about information. It's about cyber. It's about technology. And we're doing some of that, but there's not that comprehensive clarion call, you know, whether it's, you know, Truman, you know, basically identifying the Cold War and putting in a bunch of policies to do that, or Ronald Reagan, you know, talking about tearing down the wall and finishing the conflict. You know, we need, I think, a greater strategic focus on what the fight actually is.
Let me ask you one last budget question in that case. You have been saying for the longest time, I mean, I was telling to somebody that actually there's, and you and I have talked about this, almost a role reversal, whereas the Democrats that are talking sometimes more about the debts than Republicans are, even though that has long been a Republican talking point. But there is this sense of, when do you think this budget is going to be peaking, and at what point do we have to actually think of the flattening or the build down, given that there's no way that the amount of money that this kind of money is sustainable over the long term?
Well, I think we need a more sensible fiscal policy. We don't have to balance the budget. This doesn't have to be austerity. All right, but when we look at our revenue, and I ask the revenue part, the last 15 years we have reduced our revenue coming in from corporate taxes, coming in from taxes paid by the very, across the board. We got to look at the spending side as well. Get us on a more fiscally sustainable path. That's not a balanced budget. It's just not a recipe to a debt and a deficit that's beyond what we can manage. I think we do need to do that, and the sooner the better.
One last quick follow-up, which is, the Air Force, for example, is proposing a budget in which it looks like it's going to have some major trade-offs in terms of cutting capability. What's the right way to get Congress to support this? Because at the end of the day, it is goring different people's axes. Yeah. And if we have to make these kind of big trade-offs, what's the right way to make them to keep people like you happy at the end of the day, but also to make the change we need to make?
The answer is slowly and painfully. I'm going to be fine. I've never been a terribly parochial legislator. I don't think it's my job to bring back as much money as is humanly possible to the state of Washington or my district. It's my job to properly provide for the national security of this country, and that includes being fiscally responsible. Not every member, I think, shares my viewpoint on that. So it's going to be slow and it's going to be difficult. Yeah, you come up with an idea to save money, it's going to be in somebody's area, and they're going to fight it. We have to figure out how to compromise and how to work through that and get us on a more fiscally sustainable path.
Adam Smith, Washington Democrat, Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Sir, it's always an honor and pleasure. Thank you very much.
Good to see you. Appreciate it.
And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. And joining us now is Admiral Phil Davidson, the commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, the oldest, largest U.S. combatant command covering more than 100 million square miles, or 52% of the Earth's surface, with a force of 375,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and Coast Guardsmen, as well as civilians, from the west coast of the United States to Asia and from the North Pole to the South Pole. Admiral Davidson, it's a real honor and pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Vago, for having me today. You know, today is December 7th. The 78th commemoration of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And of course, as you think about the United States' presence in the region and all the nations that are there in the Indo-Pacific, they go back to that date and all the actions that the United States has taken in the post-war environment to help assure a rules-based international order that's evolving to a free and open Indo-Pacific is in everyone's interest, is a shared security concern, and has led to a global economy that has lifted literally hundreds of millions out of poverty across the Indo-Pacific region, and something we'd like to continue to be able to do.
It is extraordinary, and Pax Americana has been great, but at the same time, it's also what's allowed China to develop unprecedented capabilities. The United States has looked at it as an important trading partner, and over time, we're in a position now where China is developing a vast array of capabilities. Time and again, we seem to be surprised at Chinese capabilities. They wouldn't turn geographic features into islands. Well, we don't think that they'll be projecting power on a global basis. They're a regional power. Whereas on each one of these things, we've been surprised. From your standpoint, as you look at this, there is an incrementalism to it, but also remarkable audacity, enormous amounts of coordination. For a state-sponsored system, there's also a lot of innovation and churn in their overall system. From your standpoint, do we have the right mental framework that we're bringing to this to anticipate better what China is going to do, what it's going to do next, whether it's on the military side of things, whether it's on the diplomatic side of things, or on the economic side of things.
Yeah.
There's a friend who talks about China as playing sort of three-dimensional Go, that we look at as a race. As the gun goes off, we race, we win. And whereas theirs is a very incremental way of doing things, sort of boiling the frog analogy, right, to present you with a kind of a fait accompli at the end of the day. Are we in the right headspace? I mean, how are you thinking about this competition and how they're competing in it? Do we understand how they're doing it enough to be able to thoughtfully counter it?
Well, that's a part and parcel of the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. It is indeed speaks to a whole of nation strategy. And whether you're talking about the diplomatic engagements and step up that we've done in the region from the Pacific Island chain, not just within Indo-PACOM and our engagements with the Pacific Island chain nations, but the State Department, the Interior Department, who's responsible for elements of it, you know, their step up, the passage of the BUILD Act last year and the signing it into law by the president evolves our developmental assistance, frees capitalists and private investment in the region in a way in which we haven't been able to do in the past. You heard Secretary Esper talk today about Indo-PACOM as his priority theater and trying to get resources there quickly. You know, this all speaks to a whole of government apparatus that's, you know, pursuing this. One of the things I would highlight for people that I think, you know, stands out besides just the security sphere was President Trump's meeting with the three presidents from the freely associated states of the Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, and the Republic of the Marshall Islands back in the spring. And then Secretary Pompeo's announcement in August, the agreement to renegotiate the economic vehicle, given the upcoming expiration of the economic elements of the compact with those freely associated states, what that means to the security of the United States, what it means for those nations to continue in their free association with us, both in a security sense and an economic sense as well.
Part of the question that I asked, and I thought I just want to give you one more opportunity if you want to be able to address it, of are we as good at strategic foresight as we need to be? Are you comfortable with where you are in your ability to sort of understand as a command what they're doing, where they're going, so that you can sort of, not to overuse an analogy, skate to where the puck's going to be as opposed to chasing the puck?
Well, you know, certainly as I think about this most recent era of counterinsurgency and constabulary operations, you know, it took some time for the intelligence apparatus, for example, you know, to pivot from activities they were doing beforehand to actually get after all the challenges, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, ISIS as well. Do we need to see those kind of bureaucratic changes across the whole of the apparatus? Yeah, sure. More can be done to get after the Indo-Pacific Command as a priority in all elements of what we do in the military.
At the West Coast Aerospace Forum, there was a lot of candid discussion about whether the capabilities we have today are actually going to be applicable to China, and that the risks of that are, as soon as the Chinese don't believe there's a deterrent, that's only going to fuel misbehavior. Mm-hmm. From your standpoint, how different does the composition of our force need to be? Mm-hmm. Sort of what's working that you want more of? What's maybe not working that you think you need less of at a time when folks are talking that the future fiscal environment might be a little bit tighter?
Yeah. I always think, you know, the dangerous time for any sort of transition, whether you're talking about a transition in business or a transition in strategy or a transition in security environment, is, you know, during the time of transition. 75% of the stuff we have today is the stuff that's going to be in the fight in 10 years, if there were to be a fight. So it's equipping that those formations with the proper equipments, the TTP, the people with intellectual education, and the training to go after that. I've been quite pleased with the way the services have been introducing these new service concepts, from multi-domain operations to the distributed maritime operations that the Navy Marine Corps team has been discussing, and what the way ahead is. You know, we're in the throes of the budget discussion here for 21 right now, and I feel pretty good about the way Indo-Pacific Command's concerns have been addressed. And we'll have to see how it comes out here at the end of the month.
Do you feel that, I mean, you, for example, have been waiting, or your predecessors have been waiting for a ship-launched long-range anti-ship missile for a long time. Mm-hmm. Each one of the services are making these decisions, and yet you, at the end of the day, are the most important customer for some of these capabilities. Do you feel that the views of the command and your needs, some of which are rather dire and somewhat more immediate? I mean, somebody made a joke to me, you may say a peer is the most important thing, and somebody looks at a POM document and goes, hey, boss, don't worry, 2028, we'll have some funding turned on. And you're thinking, like, I need that peer a lot faster than you guys are thinking about this. Are we moving fast enough to be able to get you the kind of capabilities you need? Because at the end of the day, it's the most important part of the deterrent equation.
Yeah, well, you know, Vago, every commander wants things more, and they want things faster. I'm quite pleased to, you know, to have the Air Force be out in front on LRASM. You know, the Navy did its first certification of the Super Hornet to carry LRASM as well. We've got our first two littoral combat ships out rotating out of Singapore right now, one of them with a long-range missile on the bow. You know, I see the department starting to pivot to the investments that are going to be required to continue to deter over the next decade.
We know we have a $23 billion multi-year plan for Europe in order to help deter Russia, which was very, very important, particularly in the wake of Russia's Ukraine invasion and annexation. Do we need a similar kind of a fund like that in the Pacific, where you face an anti-access area denial challenge that spans across the entire theater, and in some respects is as serious as anything that European nations are facing in with Russia?
Yeah. There is a funding vehicle called the IPSI, the Indo-Pacific Stability Initiative, it's now known as. That wasn't the first name. But it was authorized as part of the NDAA, I think, 2 years ago. It has not been appropriated against just yet. It remains out there as a vehicle in which to resource to get after Indo-Pacific Command capability and capacity equities directly. That's certainly something that's been an ongoing discussion really in the department and across the USG as well.
Let me ask you one last question, which is agile. Well, it's two-part question. Agile basing is something that's important across the region. It's increasingly seen as a way for U.S. forces to operate in that first island chain environment. But there are those who say that that's actually a non-starter, that that is actually too risky of a strategy, especially in a hypersonic environment. What's your position? I mean, do you think that the agile basing concept is something that is really a viable way to operate across the region, especially in an unfortunate instance where the shooting does start?
Geography has been important in warfare going back to antiquity, and it's going to remain important in the future going forward. And it's important that we have options available to us to deter in the day-to-day, to deter in the transition to crisis, and certainly to deter war overall, and then fight and win when it's necessary. We're a long way away from a silver bullet that could be controlled from Washington. And, oh, by the way, then what else are you defending besides Washington?
Allies and partners are very, very important. And right now, two of arguably among your most important partners, South Korea and Japan, their relationship is a little bit fraught right now. I know that you on the military side and everybody on the military side is trying to keep that together, but the political tensions remain. And there are those who see that the basing demands by Washington are exacerbating that tensions. As the Indo-Pacific commander, what's the role you're playing to make sure that at the end of the day, that military alliance that is so important to deterring China remains whole? And at some point, the worst case scenario would be, for example, Seoul or Tokyo looking at U.S. forces and saying, hey, I want you guys to get out.
Listen, the relationships at the mill-to-mill relationship are absolutely rock solid. Our alliance with the Republic of Korea is ironclad. I was just there in the last couple of weeks, met with General Park. Shortly thereafter, you know, VTC'd with General Park and General Yamazaki in Japan as well. I've got the highest amount of confidence in these relationships. I have to tell you, you know, the Japanese and General Yamazaki himself, there is a transparency to our bilateral discussions and planning that has never existed before. So I'm looking forward to that. You know, the issues of burden sharing are policy issues and political issues. It's up to the State Department to negotiate those things. I need to leave them all the room they need to negotiate these things.
Admiral Phil Davidson, Commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. Sir, it was an honor and pleasure talking to you. Thank you so very much for being so generous with your time.
Thank you. It was great to see you again, Vogel.
The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is sponsored by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight, bellflight.com. And joining us now for the roundtable to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Ron, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Parker.
And Richard Abalafi of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Richard, thank you for making some time for us on this weekend.
Always the highlight of my weekend, Vago.
Thanks very much. That's very, very kind. All right, Ron, let's start with you. Very big order from United, 50 of the A321 XLR jets. Talk to us about what this really means, because this is kind of a really big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the first time United has bought a narrow body from Airbus since 1998. And of particular significance here is they're using the A321 XLRs to replace their fleet of 757s. So this is another, a vote of confidence that the A321 XLR is a legit replacement for the 757. Now on the heels of this deal, right, you'll have United and Delta and American. United and American have explicitly said they've ordered A321 XLRs. Delta has a big order for A320s and A321s. It's not a big leap of imagination to think that Delta is going to convert some of those to XLRs. All the U.S. majors are going to be operating A321 XLRs to replace their 757s.
So what does that mean for the NMA for Boeing, right? I mean, the company has been working now for we've been talking already about this on the podcast for 3 years, about what that next generation airplane looks like in this middle of the market. Has this basically completely changed that calculus as far as you're concerned? And Richard, want to get your take as well.
Yeah, I mean, it impacts it for sure, right? I mean, if you try to estimate what is the market size for the NMA, our best guess is it's maybe 2,000, 2,500 airplanes. If you look at just what the U.S. majors have ordered, that could be, on the order of maybe 20% of that market, gone already, right? Like already taken up by Airbus. The NMA is supposed to overlap, our sense of it, right, is it's supposed to overlap both the 757 and the 767. The A321 XLR for sure gets the lower end of that piece of the market. So maybe there is, some more market out there for a larger airplane. But my understanding is that some of the feedback that Boeing's gotten on the NMA is that, in fact, the airlines don't want an airplane that's so big, that they're looking for something that's maybe a little bit smaller. So, in short, and I'd be very interested to hear what Richard has to say, it does seem like, and we kind of wrote this week, that this might put the NMA program kind of in deep storage for a while or on ice, if you will.
Richard?
Yeah, boy, I mean, there's two possibilities here. One, either it's been put on the shelf for a very long time, a very high shelf, or it's still going ahead, but it really shouldn't. Because I think at this point, the market is screaming very loudly that it wants a single aisle jet, and it remains very hard to see how they can harmonize twin aisle and single aisle manufacturing economics and operating economics. It's super hard. And while we're debating about what makes a good 757 replacement, remember, over 25 years, they sold 1,049 757s, and it was considered a success. Since it was introduced on the market in 2011, they've sold 3,200, almost exactly three times as many A321s as 757s. That's a remarkable success. And when you think about it, this is not the time for Boeing to say, okay, we missed out, our bad. I think this gets to be a much, much bigger market than anyone imagined. Just like big aircraft proved to be far more far smaller and the forecast far bigger than reality. I think this is one of those cases where airline strategy really does come to embrace aircraft and the 321 and just above it class. And Boeing, I think, still has an opportunity here to do something. I just don't think it should be a twin aisle.
Yeah, so what I would add to, what I guess worries me is, how Boeing responds to this, meaning, In light of what's happened with the 737 MAX, are we going to get into an environment where the company is going to focus on trying to recover the lost cash flows, trying to please Wall Street, if you will, and cut back on program development, maybe right at the wrong time? Maybe this is the time where the company should be amping up its R&D spend instead of cutting it back. I kind of suspect, to make the street happy, what we might hear from the company as we go into next year is, hey, you know what, to try to offset some of the costs related to the 737 MAX program, we might start ramping down research. The NMA is kind of pushed out there. Next single aisle is pushed out there. And we might get into this environment where new product development really kind of slows down at Boeing. And it kind of seems like, at least at first glance, you know, that might not be the right strategy right now.
Richard?
Yeah, I could not agree more. This is not the time to throttle back. And I think, once again, you've got those pivotal moments where they're battling for the future of Boeing. I think what I find most concerning is that there don't appear to be a lot of champions of new product development that you meet at Boeing. Most people are either reacting to the problem associated with the MAX, or if they were a champion, they championed NMA, which, you know, and you know, Kevin McAllister, when he was head of BCA up until a few weeks ago, was known as an NMA champion. I'm not so sure that Stan Deal is going to take up the mantle with something new. Obviously, his priority before that was product support. He's very respected, but is he going to be an airplane person? Is he going to be a champion for a new jet? So I'm a little concerned what happens to Boeing at this point, whether it returns to its roots as a company that develops new jets when needed and basically comes up with the best solution for the problem, or if it simply goes back to giving back all its cash to shareholders. It's going to be a pivotal moment.
Let's go to the latest 737 MAX news flow. Where are we on the program, certification, FAA, Europeans, everybody else? Ron?
So, Vago, this week, the FAA put out, I think it's an operational review document, and that document went out for public review. Public review is 30 days. They weren't, if it's 30 calendar days, 30 working days, that's a little bit unclear. But it was December 4th, so if we assume it's just 30 calendar days, that puts you into early January. Then if they get any, you know, comments back, they have to address those comments, right? So when you look at the review period of the operating document, that suggests to me that you're at best probably now you get an airworthiness directive from the FAA if everything kind of goes relatively swimmingly early February, something like that. And then we're expecting, you know, EASA probably another 2 months behind that. And then on all those, you know, on the AD from the FAA and then the AD, if you will, from EASA, add about another two and a half months for aircraft to get back into the schedules of airlines, right? So it kind of looks like you're talking April schedules for the US airlines and then probably June schedule for the European airlines, from kind of what we know today.
Richard?
I think the big theme here is that Boeing continues to be surprised that it's not in the driver's seat. You know, you had that moment a couple weeks ago where the FAA said that they couldn't do individual plane inspections and whatever else themselves. They would be doing it. The FAA would be doing it. And now you've got this requirement for a 30-day comment period. All of this says that, yeah, Boeing is confident it has the right technical solution, and it's been coming up with timeframes based upon that confident expectation. But the reality is that the regulators, at first the FAA, and as Ron says, the others beyond that, are really in the driver's seat here. And that creates a high level of uncertainty.
Yeah, to be fair to Boeing, ultimately, however, in their messaging, they have been clear that, you know, their deadlines were subject to the risk of regulators that they can't control. So ultimately it's that risk that is kind of coming up, it seems, right? So, but one does have to wonder why, you know, it's been sort of like a walk the dog kind of thing where they set an expectation, they miss it. They set an expectation, they miss it. Where if this risk, you know, has been there and they've articulated it, maybe, you know, set an expectation that's something you can meet or beat, even though that might be not popular at the time, but you know, when you actually meet it or beat it, you'll be rewarded for it.
And Richard, I want to move on, talk about the partnership between SNECMA and MTU. There's an agreement now, two companies partnering to build the common engine for the French, German, Spanish fighter aircraft, the SCAF, that was announced at the Paris Air Show. Talk to us a little bit about the agreement and what it means.
Yeah, you know, I think it's important, because, you know, frankly, there are good reasons to doubt the ability of these two, well, two countries plus Spain, if you will. Spain's going to play a smaller role because of the smaller size of its industry and its requirement. But the idea of harmonizing French and German industry to build a combat aircraft was always fraught with difficulties. You know, you've got Dassault taking lead. What does that leave for, well, German aircraft industries, be it under the guise of Airbus or whoever? You've always had Thales taking lead in electronic warfare, radar. What does that leave for German industry? And then on the engine side, of course, there was never any doubt that Safran is going to be in charge of the engine. What does that leave for German industry? And, you know, you could argue that this was sort of the one easy one, that MTU would always be happy to accept an ancillary role in the engine for the fighter. But at least it is progress. They were able to reach an agreement that didn't give the French too much at German expense. And perhaps there's a way forward from the standpoint of the airframe, the EW package and radar and whatever else, that maybe there's a way to make this work. But of course, it's just one step of many.
Ron, anything you want to add to that? Or there's one superjet question I've got. Anything else to add on the MTU SNECMA deal?
Nope. Yeah. Richard's right on.
I forgot to raise potential order by Serbian Air of the Superjet. Something important, obviously, for our audience. That was a collaborative program between Sukhoi and Alenia. Pretty nice little airplane. Is this sort of a needle change for it? Because it sort of hasn't logged that many sales, has it?
Yeah, no, it's been suffering. So if they do get some orders from Serbian, that would be good. You know, the Serbian Air was looking at both it and the MC-21, my understanding. So maybe, you know, two of the local champions, if you will. And there's been some headlines recently that they might be converging in on a deal for the Superjet, which would give a little bit of wind in the sails of the program.
And Richard, why is it so important? The most important 321 XLR deal, as far as you're concerned, is Air Malta. Explain.
Well, before I do, just one quick comment on Superjet. You know, for many years, about a decade, Interjet of Mexico was held up as the headline Western market access moment for the Superjet. And they've been phasing out their fleet, and they're pretty unhappy with it. It's not the jet itself, it's the product support, which they said was pretty awful. And in that decade, the Superjet folks have failed to get any other Western customer, despite false starts with VLM, with Citybird in Belgium, I believe, and a couple of others. So yeah, they really need this. What intrigues me about the 321 XLR and the middle market in general is just how much potential it has to revolutionize travel. You think about 5,000 nautical mile, relatively thin routes. This week, Air Malta announced they were looking at the type. I'd be thrilled. You know, I mean, I love Malta. And to get there, you have to fly and then wait interminable hours at, take your pick, Frankfurt, Heathrow, or Charles de Gaulle. This would conceivably allow people in America to go directly to Malta. That's, of course, one of many examples like that. You think about the potential here. You get more pricing power if you're an airline to fly people directly. And you save money because you have exactly half as many takeoffs and landings with the same passenger. You don't have to, you know, land and take off from Charles de Gaulle, for example. So it's eco-friendly, it saves money, and it brings in more revenue. I think the market for new mid-sized aircraft like the 321 XLR is far greater than anybody had been estimating.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. And I second what Richard says. Any opportunity to get rid of a layover and fly direct is good in my book. I'd much rather fly direct to Abu Dhabi if I've got to get to Dubai. If I can't get a Dubai flight, I'm going to Abu Dhabi and I'm taking a cab as opposed to going through someplace else. So I'm all for that idea.
The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. And joining us now are Michelle Colas Brooks, playwright of War Words, and Steve Grunman of the Atlantic Council Think Tank, who've collaborated on a new play debuted in workshop form at the Pacific Resident Theater in Venice, California, where we're doing this interview just before opening night. Michelle, tell us a little bit about this project and what made you do it.
So War Words is accumulation of interviews I've done with people who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan during the long war. And my intention was to get to know these people a little bit because I live in Venice, California. I live in a particular kind of bubble, and I don't know anybody who served. My father-in-law served in World War II. That's about the closest I've got. So I always identified people in the military as sort of other, and I decided I wanted to understand what motivated them and to get their personal stories so that we could begin to understand, people like me could begin to understand, and maybe have a little bit more ownership and a little bit more compassion for people who take on service.
And talk to us about the process you went to be able to produce the kind of authentic experience, which is, as a playwright, what you're always shooting to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Well, I basically just put the word out to everybody I knew that I was interested in interviewing people from the military. I wanted to interview a range of people from, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, men, women, all different shapes and sizes, and just hear as many personal stories as possible. So this is their words. I mean, there are some characters are combined and some liberties are taken, but I believe the authenticity comes from these being real people who were generous enough to open themselves up and tell their stories.
And what were the key takeaways for you as somebody from the arts who didn't really know very much about the military?
I just finally started to care. You know, I actually just this afternoon, I read about the Black Hawk that crashed in Minnesota. And when I read things like that, I would have always viewed them as a tragedy, but it makes me very emotional now. I sort of just kind of understand more the scaffolding of these people that have achieved these positions and what they go through and the tragedy of what they suffer. So I care more now. And I pay a little bit more attention to policy that sends these people out. And what I don't know how much I can do, but I think paying attention is a really good start.
So that they're not just statistics or just, you know, five people died in Afghanistan or Iraq. Steve, you and I have been friends for a very, very long time. You were a distinguished captain in the United States Army during the height of the Cold War, having served in Germany. Tell us how you and the Atlantic Council became involved in this project with Michelle.
Sure. So it really goes back to 2016, late 2016, and the development of programming priorities for the year ahead. For 2017 at the Atlantic Council, all of us would recall that 2016 politically, both here and in Europe, the United Kingdom in particular, were marked by, let's just summarize it, a populist rejection of globalization. In this country, to some degree, one might say a rejection of America's leadership in the world, or at least as that leadership role had been expressed over the preceding 20 years, let's say across the duration of the long war.
Well, and let's be honest, you're talking about the election of Donald Trump. Yes, you're talking about Brexit in the United Kingdom.
And so I took that mandate from the Atlantic Council's leadership, and through a confluence of events, no kind of linear path to joining Michelle in this project, but through a confluence of events decided this could be my contribution to that programming priority. How so? We're going to cultivate a citizenry that at least pays attention to America's role in the world, if not supports the idea, which the Atlantic Council as an institution does, of America's leadership in the world. We need to start to get them to care about it. That verb that Michelle invoked, I think, does come to mind here. And that's what this play, I think, would do, and I hope it does in a way that has not been done before. I think if my own opinion is that popular treatments of our warriors in the long war fail at kind of both ends of a spectrum. One is they fail in both cases because they keep warriors at an arm's length from us, at kind of a comfortable arm's length from us. They're either heroes, villains, or to be sympathized, you know, to be sympathized with in some manner or another. And I think what Michelle has done in this play is, to coin a phrase, humanized them, made warriors someone with whom the word I am hoping for an audience will have an affinity with. They'll walk out of the theater and feel like I could be one of them, or I certainly know people like them, because the root emotions and experiences that are expressed in the play are going to be familiar. even though they express themselves in context which most people in the audience won't have been familiar with. But that's the drama and excitement of it.
Let me ask, you know, we're here for the Reagan, at least you and I are here for the Reagan National Defense Forum at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. And one of the questions which I want to ask you, Michelle, is, you know, that generation was, you know, certainly during the Reagan years, right, almost everybody in power was somebody who had served in World War II. An enormous number of, you know, proportion of the population had served in World War II, either on the front lines or in support capacities. You know, the generation that were used to the draft that only ended in 1974, which then for many people contributed to this sort of separation of society of those who sort of end up doing this and don't. Did you end up picking up anything about the nature of service, the nature of how maybe society should organize itself as you went through this process, this learning process?
What I picked up is that I still don't, you know, I asked everybody, why did you decide to join up? Like, what was it that compelled you? And there were some commonalities. But I don't think it's for everyone. And I don't know that it's something that should be compulsory. But I do very strongly believe now that there should be some sort of service. There should be some sort of complicity that we have, that you know, it's a democracy and we all have to take some responsibility. So I came out of it with my mind sort of on that. Like, everybody has some kind of contribution to make. Maybe not we're all, I don't think you want me in Afghanistan on the front lines, but there's something else that I can do in service to this democracy. And I just never thought about it before.
Steve?
I'm going to say I think we need an antidote to thank you for your service. Increasingly, I fear thank you for your service is an expression of an arm's length distance between us and the folks who are out at, as they say, the pointy end of the spear of foreign and defense policy. And so whether that is some form of physical service or whether it's taking in a play, reduces that distance from one of arm's length to close in affinity, maybe that's at least an easier, from a big perspective, an easier thing that larger swaths of Americans can do to work on this deficit in our society now, in the post-World War II and now post-Cold War society, this deficit of awareness of and understanding of and affinity with, I'm going to keep using that word, warriors and warrioring.
Well, I mean, right, the whole idea was smaller, more professionalized force. And then as things actually were getting worse in the war, the solution to the problem was, well, let's just give more benefits to those people who are the ones who are bearing the brunt of this, especially the people who were on their second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth combat deployments, whether going over and over back to Iraq or over and over back to Afghanistan. So I think telling and conveying that to a population and making them care is critically important. And I think that many veterans would like that very, very much as well. Because one of the things that Mike Mullen would always talk about was his concern that society would separate from the military, but the military would also separate from society, especially when you get multi-generational military families. I want to ask you, Michelle, so this is on the workshop, which was how many performances, eight, nine?
This is eight performances.
Eight performances. Talk to us about what's next in partnership as you try to bring this to a wider audience.
Steve might actually be able to speak about that a little bit more, but our hope is that we sort of get all the loose ends worked out in this production, and then we launch it in a bigger way. We've talked about that DC might be the right place for that. But my eventual goal is to is so that the play becomes something that could be done, that could be, there's already a paradigm for this. Eve Ensler wrote a play called The Vagina Monologues that she licensed for free every Valentine's Day. And all the money that is gathered from it goes to organizations that help with violence against women. I would like to see the same thing happen with this, where eventually this could become maybe a Veterans Day production, the play is licensed for free, and that all the money goes to various veterans organizations, whatever seems best fit for that. But that's my ultimate, very lofty goal for it.
Steve?
I think the play is good enough that another goal that maybe Michelle's too modest to express is a full professional production of it at either one of the great regional theaters in this country or elsewhere. The Atlanta Council's next ambition for it is indeed to stage it, stage a fully rendered, not a workshop production now, but a fully rendered professional production in Washington, in order to give it the tailwind that any work of art of this sort needs, both the artistic and the business tailwind that it needs in order to attain either any of these longer, larger ambitions that we have for it. And that's what I hope to do next year.
When next year? That's a long time next year, Steve. Well, that was unspecific, as you would tell me.
Well, Vago, this is the nature of art.
We're Washingtonians. There's no room for art.
I understand.
Give me a schedule with little diamonds on it.
Right. Well, why don't I take your question to suggest that it would help if we had some institutions or corporations or others who gave me a call and said that they'd like to get behind this. Once we have some of the financial support that it would require to put this together, I think it will be all that much easier to find a venue, an occasion, when we can put this up on a prominent stage in Washington. But we'll aim to do it in 2020, probably in the second half of the year.
I know how important this is to you. I know how important it is to the council. In any way that we can help in that process, we would love to do that because I think it's a very important story. But there is also going to be a very special performance, isn't there?
Yes, right in the middle of this run, a run that begins tonight, the 5th of December, and closes on the 15th. In the middle of it on the 12th, so Thursday the 12th of December, after the performance, General David Petraeus, who commanded U.S. and Allied forces both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course was the commander of CENTCOM between 2007-2011, he will be here to offer his own thoughts about his personal experience as a soldier and in those wars, but also to reflect on the play, to offer his thoughts about how arts and creativity can mash up with national security to get some of the heavy lifting around the engagement of our citizenry that we've talked about here. So that's next Thursday the 12th. There remain several seats still available for that performance, and if you'd like to see it, stay afterwards for the reception and the conversation with General Petraeus. That would be great.
And contribute generously.
Please, of course.
Michelle Colas Brooks, who is the playwright of War Words, Steve Grunman of the Atlantic Council. Thanks very much for spending so much time with us. I know that we've got to wrap this up because you've got a whole bunch of performers outside waiting to get in here. Look forward to talking to you both again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And check out our coverage of the Reagan Forum as well as the Halifax International Security Forum, where our coverage was sponsored by Boeing and Leonardo DRS. Watch our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Follow us on Twitter at DefAero Report. That's at DefAero Report. Like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. And check us out on LinkedIn. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again next week.